Welcome back to What Do You Want to Watch, the show hosted by myself, Nathan English, and
David Dirks.
And now I know what you're thinking right now. Neither one of us are the Lisan Al Gaib. I've drank from the water of life. I've had that precious glacier freeze Gatorade course through my veins. And I died, actually. I'm recording this
word
on a heaven-like spice world. Not dissimilar from Arrakis. We're going to talk about Dune. I mean, come on. It's what everybody's been talking about. If you went to the movie theater this past weekend, you saw Dune because nobody else watched anything else. Dune Part 2 is here. That's already being heralded as the probable best film of 2024. One of the best films of the decade so far. One of the best sequels of all time is the director now considered an all-time great director. Where does this stand among sci-fi? Where does this stand among blockbusters? All of those kinds of questions. And so we're going to talk about all of that stuff. We're going to talk about the movie itself. We'll have some spoiler-free conversations for the first 10 or 15 minutes. After that, we will get into some spoiler territory. So if you have not seen the movie yet, we will tell you when you should probably stop listening to the podcast and then go out and watch this dang thing and watch it on the biggest screen you can find. I say this all the time, but I mean it this time. Find the biggest screen you can. Watch Dune Part 2 on it. Let's go. Let's ride these sandworms. All right.
I'm trying to Javier Bardem, like, I don't know how he does that. Just so smooth, bro. It's just like, whoa.
There's a lot of voice work in this movie, actually, that I'm very impressed with. Dune Part 2. I don't
know if they heard that. They may not have even heard that when they were listening to the pod, so who knows?
It's possible. It's possible. I bet it got picked up. Dune Part 2 came out this past weekend. It has so far made $190 million worldwide at the box office. The long-awaited sequel to Denis Villeneuve's 2021 adaptation of the sci-fi classic, the 1965 novel Dune by Frank Herbert. This was an adaptation of the second half of the book. I will start out from the jump, and I would assume this is the case for you as well, David. Neither one of us have read the book. I know things about it because I've read some Wikipedia pages. I've read some plot summaries of the books. I know that there is some straying from certain things in the books. One of the people I was lucky enough to watch it with has read the first book. And so he was explaining some of the differences. I'm not going to be here to litigate what changes were made and what weren't made because I haven't read it. But also, this is just about the movie. So if you're expecting us to just go into the lore of Dune in the book, it's not going to happen. But what will happen is we will give you our instant reactions to this 2 hour and 45 minute sci-fi epic. David, you had to wait an excruciating amount of time to see this. I saw it on Friday night, late at night. You had to wait until Monday. First thoughts whenever the credits started to roll.
I was almost like overwhelmed and overstimulated. Because it was just like 3 hours of like straight just sci-fi and different color palettes and different stuff like that. So Sophie and I on the way home were like trying to like process what we just watched. And, you know, I'd talk about a scene and then something else would pop up and then something else would pop up. And then this quote and this performance, like, and it kind of slowly came back to me. But I think it was intentionally just like overstimulating. It was just an overstimulating, like intense sci-fi thriller. And like, it almost felt like every scene like had a purpose. Like there wasn't like filler stuff. There wasn't, we got to get to this part in the movie. Like every scene felt intentional. So this for 3 hours straight, my like brain was just on full, like processing and soak it in mode, you know? So this is kind of later in the outline, but my first honest thought like went to, holy crap, Austin Butler. Like it's no surprise, like he's not a good guy. You can see the trailer and you can tell, like that's not necessarily a spoiler. He looks creepy, you know, in the trailers. And man, you're not supposed to like him as, you know, as one of the antagonists, but he just did such a good job. Like, I was just blown away by I'd seen him once in Elvis, and you look at his filmography, and he's like not really been in much. Like he's fairly.
He's a Disney Channel guy. Yeah, that's how he came up.
He's like 27 or 28. But you know, he might be in his 30s, but like you just haven't heard of him much, and he just like out of nowhere, had this performance. So that was him, and then the visuals. I immediately was just like, man, I saw Denise. I think it was Denise say something about like I don't remember like a bunch of lines from iconic movies, but I remember just iconic shots in all time movies, and that's kind of what he mm-hmm. was looking for in this movie. Mm-hmm. It was like we want like every shot to be intentional and to be very good, and they're running through my head right now of just some of these like the wide shots or the you know sky shots looking down, whatever it may be. I was just like, just so good. So, and there's a lot of things I'd probably keep talking, but those are the first couple things that stood out to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that, honestly for me, I haven't seen a movie that good in theaters, since 2019, at least personally, and maybe ever. I was hearing, I think it's the hype was inescapable for this movie. As soon as it started getting released, there were a bunch of fan screenings on Sunday. It got released to the world at large. And you could go and watch these the like 5 days before it was actually coming out in theaters. There were a bunch of people. And as soon as those started happening, I saw like literal conversations. People were like, this is the best sequel since Empire Strikes Back. This is one of the best movies of the 21st century. This is the best action movie I've ever seen. This is, you know, on and on and on, everything, any high praise they could give it, it was being given. And I was super excited for this movie. I remember just being incredibly bummed out when it didn't come out in November and that they were pushing it, because mm-hmm. it was
yeah.
one of, if not my most anticipated movie of last year. And they pushed it. I was like, oh my gosh, I just got to keep waiting for this. And they didn't push it for production reasons. They didn't push it for like the normal reasons movies are pushed. They pushed it because of the strike, and they wanted the actors and the stars of the film to be there to market for it. And so it gets pushed to March, and I'm like, oh, can't wait, can't wait, can't wait. And then after seeing it, it's like, that was so worth the wait. I mean, the legitimate 5 out of 5 stars for me. And I have reverse recency bias oftentimes. I think I don't give newer movies as much credit as I give older ones. I feel like I have to sit with a movie, or a movie has to sit in the consciousness for a while to really be recognized as a masterpiece most of the time. And I won't even allow myself normally to give 5 out of 5 ratings like for a movie that has just come out. Cause I'm like, am I just being influenced by watching this on an IMAX screen, watching this like a movie that I've been waiting for so long to come out. I didn't have any of those qualms with Dune Part 2. I agree. Austin Butler's Fade Rotha was fantastic. Who stuck out to me? I mean, Rebecca Ferguson, as Jessica, our Bene Gesserit queen, was asked to do something very difficult in this film. And, like you're not really rooting for her like you were in the first one. And she's almost like a villain in a sense, but she's not really. She's an antagonist to Paul in much of the movie and what she's representing, even though he still loves her as a mother. And that dynamic between them, I thought, was so well depicted in their interactions, which became less and less. And you started to see her kind of become this like otherworldly figure throughout the film, transforming from like this human into essentially like almost a deity on Arrakis, and the way that she's communicating with the Fremen and the like true believers of the South that they often reference in this movie. I thought Chalamet was excellent. Again, rewatching the first movie, I really thought like, it really relies on his performance. There was, and this isn't really to put anybody else down, but I remember seeing conversations of like Timothée Chalamet or Tom Holland. And Tom Holland's a fine actor. Chalamet is our Leonardo DiCaprio of our generation. Mm. I'm so excited about anything that he's going to do in the future. He has so much range. And I think Zendaya. Like there was a lot of people forget the backlash of the first movie because Zendaya is only in like 10 minutes of it. And so there was a lot of like, why cast Zendaya and like put her in the marketing so much in Dune Part 1. And then she's hardly in this movie. And like, we don't get to see her until the very end, other than like dream sequences. And in this movie, she like becomes a main character. She becomes a primary protagonist, I would say, in many ways. And I thought her as Chani was just so, she really grounded the movie. And like, she was a complex character who like clearly is struggling with her fight for her people, but also her love for Paul, but her kind of hesitation with what it feels like it's coming down the pipeline later with his journey. I just thought she did a great job. Overall, I loved pretty much every single aspect of this film.
Yeah. And some other performances that were just as prevalent in the first film, Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin, and Dave Bautista were all like picked up where they left off. Were awesome. A couple new additions, and again, this isn't spoiler. I think I've seen this in every trailer. Some of these actors, we obviously mentioned Austin Butler, Florence Pugh makes her appearance in this movie, as well as Christopher Walken, and then Stellan Skarsgård returns as Baron Harkonnen, which is just one of the more chilling villains see. Just visually, it's very chilling. And then Lei Sudo. Am I saying her name right?
I think it's Leah Seydoux.
Seydoux, not Sudo. Okay. She doesn't have like an insane amount of, you know, minutes in this movie, but I feel like every time I've seen her in a film, like she just has her part locked in and you know, she understands her character. So kind of like you kind of have this similar vibe that like Christopher Nolan likes to do, and even maybe some other actors today, of like, it just feels like a loaded cast. Like it's just name after name after name after name. And just even reading some of these parts about who they almost went to or who was up for them, it's like, man, I think, you know, the casting director and Denis like made the perfect casting choices. And that kind of separates maybe good directors from great on top of all the other stuff they do, is like, they just have an idea for who they want in this role and they find that person and the person delivers. So wasn't a weak performance in this movie. And so, yeah, man, are we okay to admit that we're going to see it a second time on Saturday?
Yeah. I mean, that should tell you how much we think of this movie, is that like, I was honestly just waiting and like, when's going to be the best time for me to see this again in theaters? I need to see it for a second time in IMAX. Because the first time you're kind of just, there is a truth to this movie that it is a lot. It's a lot of plot. It's a lot of things that have to get through. It's a lot of character arcs that have to be moved pretty substantial amounts during the course of the film. So there's not really slow moments. There's not dull moments, which obviously is great, but also it means like you don't really feel like you get a respite during the course of this film. And so I would say that like seeing it a second time for me is just necessary, just so I can like feel like I can take it all in. Cause I'm sure there's going to be aspects of this movie that I'm going to pick up on the second time that I didn't pick up on the first time. And I think we need to just mention the visuals. You already talked about the color palette, but like the way that he just conceives of these action set pieces that I just don't, like the gadgets, you know, I've seen tons of sci-fi movies, and I think everybody in many ways has been trying to catch up to Star Wars, and like trying to match them in terms of uniqueness and ideas, and a lot of that hasn't been done. But like something as simple as like the jetpacks in this movie, like they just float upwards. It's like something I've never seen before. And there's one sequence where they're attacking one of these sand crawlers, and there's magnetic mines that just flip up and fly at them. Like I've never seen that before, you know, and the sounds that he uses, like it's clear that he really just values this. I mean, he obviously talked about how visuals are key for him, and so is sound. And so that all of those working together, I think just this movie is just really an experience. And it's not just that, though. I think oftentimes you can go to a movie and you can be like, wow, that was like blew me away. Lots of noises, lots of action. And that's not just this. It's also got a really good story in it and great performances as well.
Yeah. The top review for this movie is one of those movie going experiences that I'll cherish for the rest of my life. And that's like, it's dramatic, yes, but it's also true. I feel like we talk about like, My dad talks about Jaws a lot, of like him and his best friend remember walking and watching that in theaters, and they remember watching Rocky IV in theaters when, you know, America beats Russia, you know, all this stuff. And I think we'll have this idea of like, yeah, we watched Dune 2 in theaters opening weekend, and it was just insane. You know, I think this is, we'll have a group of movies that we'll be able to reference, like our dads talked about, and there's plenty of others. And I think this will probably end up in that category of like, yeah, just opening weekend was crazy. Like, you know, I wish you could experience it too, you know? So it's pretty special when a movie can be like that. And it's honestly how I feel about this. And it's, they're two different movies, but it's kind of crazy within the last, you know, less than a year, we have two movies that potentially fall in that category. I don't think Oppenheimer is as wow, because it's just not that sci-fi action thriller, but it might end up in one of those conversations of like, yeah, I saw Oppenheimer in theaters and then it won 11 of the 13 Oscars. You, like, you never, you just never know. And it's crazy. We've gotten two of films in less than a year that have been so just knockout hits. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also, if you're just thinking about it, like this, to an even more extreme extent, gave me the same feeling I had when I watched Top Gun Maverick. And I think Top Gun Maverick was a little different because it came out of nowhere. Like, I was excited to see Top Gun Maverick just because, like, it's a Tom Cruise Top Gun movie. Like, I'm going to see it. But I didn't have any expectation of it being that good. I did go into Dune Part 2 with a lot of expectations. But it's just like you're sitting back in the theater and it's like the sound is hitting you and you're watching what's happening. But Dune 2 is even above that film for me. And I love Top Gun Maverick because it just really cares about the story it's telling. And it's just, we'll get to this later. And I think that maybe now, can we just declare spoilers, I guess? I mean, you can give you can give your rating. I've already given my rating. What did you rate Dune 5. Part 2? Okay.
Yeah. 5.
I felt like it was pretty obvious by the way.
I was like, that's a 5-star movie. I was like, am I sure? Yeah, I'm sure that's a 5-star movie. There was something I want to talk about, but I wanted to preface that we should probably talk, wait, so after we reveal spoilers, so this perfect that we're kind of just going to go into that now.
So this is your spoiler warning. If you have not seen this film and you do not want anything to be spoiled for you, please, please, please just
please exit stop the premises.
Listening. Yeah, just stop listening until you can watch it. All right, David. I'll finish making the original point.
Yeah.
I think what's great about this movie too is like, it's not a happy ending, right? Like, we're in agreement, like, this is a bad ending. Not a bad ending of, like, story-wise, it's not good. Like, Paul has clearly turned a corner. And I think that was the message all along. And if you know anything about the source material, and I know I'm not doing, like, a litigation of the books, but this is supposed to be, like, an examination of the White Savior story and how you not shouldn't give all that power to one person and how that's going to end up corrupting them. And you can see, like, after Paul, as soon as Paul travels south, the thing that he was fearing, the thing that he didn't want to do, as soon as he does that and drinks the water of life, like, he just becomes different. He transforms. Like, he even speaks to Chani and says that he still loves her and will follow her forever. And it just doesn't seem like that's really true anymore. Mm. And so, like, he changes. And by the end of this movie, you're like, yeah, my guy won. My guy Paul won. He won the knife fight, you know? Both of these movies are bookended by knife fights, and he won the knife fight, and we're good. Like, that, yay, he beat the Harkonnen. But like, what's to come is probably millions of lives lost, and like, he's going to cause mass destruction in a holy war. It's like not a happy ending.
Yeah, it was kind of like, as the movie's ending, I'm like, is Paul the good guy right now? Like, he is, but I kind of got the vibe of like,
he's not going to be for much longer.
Now they're about to fight the other houses and a lot of people are going to die. It's like, I mean, he probably is the protagonist, but war is brutal. And, you know, you're right though. Like, once he goes south, like, even Timothy as an actor completely changes. And I just ate it up. I'm like, he's so good. Like, he just flipped a switch. Mm-hmm. Dude, when he yells silence to the mother, Reverend Mother, oh my gosh, that was
And I was
wild.
Like, we were all like, there are people cheering in my theater when that happened, and everybody was happy for it, but then like, you just start to process what's about to happen, what you feel is coming, because his prophecies are coming true. Like, he says to, I don't know why, I can't remember the name of Josh Brolin's character, just give me Gurney.
uncle or
yeah, he says to Gurney Halleck, who's the Brawlon character, is the general that we never see after the Harkonnens, you know, night raid in Dune Part One. He says to him, like, everything, all my prophecies or all my visions, they turn to horror. And he goes, when you lose power, and he goes, no, when I gain it. And that's what he does when he moves south. And, like, everything that is he has envisioned has come true. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of seeing that happen.
Yeah, my favorite scene of the movie had to be that knife fight. And I read this before, so I didn't necessarily just notice this in the film. But the intentionality of to not include any music, but simply just the fight on that knife fight was genius. Because, like, mm-hmm. this whole movie is Hans Zimmer just blowing your eardrums. And then it gets quieter, 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 quieter. And it's just a knife fight. And I thought that was so clean and this intentional mm-hmm. and effective. And that was such a good scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think
and that little spin move he did. You know what I'm talking about? That little spin move?
Mm. Yeah. Well, because he was getting his butt kicked half of it, most of the fight he was losing. And you knew he was going to win. You're just trying to figure out how, you know?
Yeah.
I thought Denis did many things masterfully. The first one is just like, none of this stuff looks corny. You know how, like, so you can watch a sci-fi movie and it's just like, this looks corny. Like, these creatures look corny. These people look corny. Like, this just looks like a mess. I watched, I'm not ashamed that I did this. It's just, I wasted 2 hours of my life. I watched Aquaman 2 this past weekend. And it sucks. Like, it just sucked because everything, like, they were trying to make things so cool and inventive. And, like, he goes to this different part of the ocean and you're looking at it and it's supposed to be all these cool creatures and everything is dumb. Like, it just looks CGI, like copy ripoff of Star Wars. There's even like a discount Jabba the Hutt character in Aquaman 2 that just really was annoying me. But like it, Villeneuve obviously is I think you can see the clear parallels to the movies like 2001, which he's been very open about his love for Kubrick, but he just has a unique vision for this stuff. But it looks like it's practical. Like, in this world, it looks practical. The suits look practical. Like the stilt suits, the weapons that they use look practical. Like, even down to like the guns that are firing, and the shields make sense. Like, you can't fire through the shield. You have to wait. Like, everything seems practical. Everything seems grounded. And it seems like he truly cared about making this world feel lived in, which is not easy to do with a sweeping sci-fi epic, but it's mm-hmm. something he really focused on. And I thought that was genius. And then the other thing that I thought was the Harkonnens, which TJ talked about. How do you feel about the Harkonnens as the villains? I mean, they're now kind of, I think they've been toppled as the primary antagonist of this series so far, but how did you feel about them?
I liked him as a villain. I thought they were I feel like there's like levels of villains, and there's kind of like they're evil, obviously, but then there's like a whole nother type of evil where they like kind of like don't play by the rules that you're supposed to play by, and it kind of makes it like this, it kind of takes you outside of this like controlled universe of like there are certain rules you follow, good or bad. And so some of the things they do that are kind of like, that's messed up and that's cheating and that's not how we're supposed to do this. And I think they even mentioned at one point, Stilgard even mentioned like they fired from air without warning. Like that's not how things are supposed to roll. And it's just this whole idea of like, they're cruel. And also the fact that the first movie, the premise around them, you know, not doing what they're supposed to do and wiping out an entire house, but, or what they thought at least. I liked him, and the an all black like suit,
yeah,
as you're an evil guy, like that's just a classic. Like, I like it. They're the pale bald white, and the,
I mean, they look like
all
skin
black suit. It like it looks legit. Yeah. It looks clean, and
it's
we'll probably get into this, but man, the world, even that world that we got introduced to,
right?
Wicked, man. It looks so good,
which is why it like explains them. You know, you now understand, because you're watching the Harkonnens and you're like, that what I think of and what I think they clearly resemble, and I'm sure this is intentional, is skinheads. I mean, they're pale, they're bald, they're evil. That's not like, it's not a huge leap to make that distinction. But then you see their planet and you see why they're pale. You don't necessarily see why they're bald, except that it seems like they want to kill individuality as much as possible. But like the Baron is obviously so, I mean, just he's this grotesque figure. He's like a slug person who's constantly like floating around. And half the time we see him in a scene, he's sitting in a pool of ooze and he's just like vaping and it's really disgusting. But they're just, they're pure evil. Like I think about when they're on Arrakis and he's, the Baron's being frustrated and you can hear him behind a closed door, just killing servants, just murdering them. You can hear them scream and then they just open the door and walk in and they're dead. You know, like there's nothing redeemable about these people. There's multiple kinds of villains and there's complex, you know, villains. And I think there's been a rise of this in recent movies. Like, oh, he had a point, you know, like he you know, was right about things, but he just did it in the wrong way. That's none of that with the Harkonnens. And I don't need them to be. They're evil. Mm-hmm. They're pure evil. That's all they are. Feyd-Rautha is the same way. And I mean, and they even say it, the Bene Gesserit say it, like he is psychotic, but we think he can be controlled. And that's why we're going to side with him. Because he's evil. He's violent. He, to test how sharp his knives are, he just kills people, just innocent people around him, just starts
and then
murdering
feeds
him
to his other like,
yeah, and then
servants.
Feeds him, it's to his cannibalistic like harem that he's got, you know, like these are, this is like is I think as violent and as scary as you can make villains in a PG-13 movie, seriously.
Yeah,
like I don't know if you can go any further.
I agree. It was, I was kind of like, this is always tough, but we were the first ones in the theater and there were only like maybe half a dozen of us. Now it's a Monday at 5 p.m. so that's not an ideal movie watching time. But the next people in that followed us was like this family and they had like three people, they had like three kids that were like second grade, third grade and like fifth grade. And I was like, you sure you want to be bringing your second grader to this movie? And it was pretty dark, pretty messed up at times. I'm like, bro, why are you bringing your kids to this thing? Like, this is, you know, I know it's PG-13, but like, Denis pushed it, which, you know, at the intensity that this world is building to, like, it kind of makes sense of like where the paths are heading and where this war is kind of taking these people. And honestly, just who these houses are and what they do. Like, it makes sense that it got dark, but I was just surprised, like, dang.
Mm-hmm. Something I was surprised by in this movie as well. I mean, it was dark, but and for that's not actually new for Villeneuve movies. I mean, you can think about like if you've ever seen Prisoners, like, golly, that's one of the darkest movies I've seen in my lifetime. I think genuinely, it's just like kind of a heartbreaking film.
Even Sicario has like a,
oh yeah, Sicario is real dark
kind of
too,
bend the rules, shoot first, ask questions, you know, like
there's a lot of parallels between this and Sicario. I think another thing is like there's humor injected into this one that I didn't expect. And I think it's a lot of, I think Villeneuve is probably being intentional about it, but it's also like Javier Bardem has just like made it his role, I think. Because in the first movie we barely get to see him, but he just seems like kind of a self-serious, like mistrusting member of the Fremen who like is accepting Paul but isn't super happy about it. And in this movie, he's like so convinced that Paul is the Messiah, that Paul is the Lisan al Gaib, that he's like, and when Paul's like, I'm not that, I'm not their Messiah, I'm not the savior, he's like, of course the savior would be so humble as to not think that he's the savior. You know, he's like hyping Paul up at every situation. I thought that was hilarious. And I thought there were definitely some funny Zendaya lines as well. I mean, she's mocking Paul for like, you know, out of touch white boy trying to adapt to living in the desert. I thought there was some definite humor in this movie, but I think the last 20 minutes are pretty devoid of all of it. Unless you find it funny that Christopher Walken's just in this, which I'm not saying that's a problem, but every time Christopher Walken was on the screen and he was, you know, doing his walk and he's like, now the Harkonnens are a problem. It's just like, it's kind of funny, but
he does kind of look like a good evil emperor though, doesn't he?
Oh yeah,
like,
absolutely.
It just fits.
He fits the vibe. He fits the vibe very, very well.
All I could think about when they're talking about him being the chosen one and the Messiah to come, literally the only thing I could think about was when Harry Potter goes, but I am the chosen one, and Hermione like punches him. I just, like, five times in that movie, I just thought of that quote, and I just, I couldn't get out of my head. I couldn't.
Mm-hmm. I thought also I hinted at this earlier in our spoiler free conversations. I think that Chani is the true like protagonist of this film in the way that I think she's the one who we're supposed to root for. She's mistrusting at first. She's like clearly against the prophecy, which is interesting when you cast that against her relationship to Paul. And Paul is obviously the what many people believe is the fulfillment of this prophecy. And Zendaya is against the prophecy. Her character is Chani. For the purpose of, she thinks it's just being used to control Fremen. She's all about action. That's what she's doing. She's helping lead these raids. She's helping try to cripple spice production on her planet. She's doing all this because she thinks that Fremen need to take action. And the reason that they have been struggling and have been hiding themselves in the desert for thousands of years is because they've just been waiting on this prophecy, that it's just made them lackadaisical and that it's made them sit and submissive because they are waiting on the people who are oppressing them to bring them their savior. Because obviously the Atreides are projected and portrayed as better than the Harkonnens in terms of masters of Arrakis, but they're still outsiders who are invading a world and depleting it of its natural resources. And whether they have a friendly relationship with the people on the planet or not, that's what they're doing. And so I think that's it, and it's the point of view, I think, of Villeneuve in the movie that, like, what no matter what your thought is, what they're doing is wrong, even if it has good outcomes for some people in the galaxy. Like, what they're doing is wrong. And Chani seems to be the embodiment of that. And at the end of the movie, you can see that too, when she like chooses not to follow Paul. Like, she could very easily, which the only time in my life I've ever been like, why would you choose Florence Pugh? When he gets to that point in the movie and he chooses Florence Pugh, who's playing the Emperor's daughter, is like, take your hand in marriage, and you just cut to Chani's face and you're just gut wrenched, you're heartbroken for her. Because I think she is like, she's the one that stuck beside him. She's the one that followed him. And she sees him turning. She sees what he's becoming, and she doesn't like it because she thinks it's going to lead her people. It's not best for her people. It's not freeing them. Like, yeah, they can overthrow their masters on Arrakis, but he's now going to use the Fremen as his personal army in a holy war. In what way is that freeing them? It's just making them subservient to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, though, that him, you know, choosing Florence Pugh was more like political and like easing the situation? Because like, I think I do believe when he says, I will always love you, because I think he knew what he was about to do. And so I think he wanted her to hear that before he made that decision. And whether that's the case or not, I guess it's still kind of messed up. But I don't think he did that because he actually chose her, but he did it because of like, it's political. Like, he has to.
Obviously, there's not like romantic feelings involved, because to our knowledge, it's the first time he's ever met her, or maybe he's met her once before. But I think what's pretty obvious in that situation is that, one, he has completely turned from, I don't want this, to now I'm taking this. I am now fully embracing, which he already does earlier in the movie when he gives the speech in the siege in the south, and he is declaring himself Duke of Arrakis and Lisan al-Ghaib, and says that he is the one that's going to unite them and bring them all together and overthrow their masters. But he's fully just embracing that, and I think you're right, it's a political move. But if you love someone, are you going to marry somebody else for a political move? Like, sure. I will always love you, like, you're the one for me, or whatever that means to him. Like, he betrays that and betrays her in that moment. You can say it's the right move politically for whatever his aspirations are, or even for freeing the planet, but I don't know if it's better for her.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So it was interesting, and I understand, but she was like mad at him, and then he did that, and then she was mad at him for other reasons. So I just thought that was funny. But like, she wasn't mad at him like, I never want to see you again. She was just mad at him at the situation. And then he chose Florence, and then it's like, oh, you care now. But
and I think she's clearly going to come back. I mean, I don't.
Yeah,
I
she
think,
has to.
But I think it's very intentional that we don't end with Paul. The movie ends on her. The movie ends on Chani going back and writing the sandworm. And kind of forging her own path, which I don't think she was. I mean, she wasn't doing the whole movie in service to Paul, but I think she kind of felt that way of like, I've been following you this entire time because I wanted one thing for my people, and now it doesn't seem like you value that. And I think that that was the movie saying, like, this is her point of view. This is what we're showing you, is that she's the one that we should believe in. She's the one that's doing the good. Now, that's just my view of it, I guess. Mm. So,
yeah, I agree, though. I think it is very intentional. It's like, you know, oh, Paul's the main character. It's like, well, the movie ended on her, mm-hmm. you know. So, I'm curious. I really am curious, you know, where this goes, because, I mean, the other four or five houses are right there. Like, it feels like Messiah is going to start and the war is going to start. So I'm just curious, like, how she's going to end up, you know, back there. And we're probably gonna have to wait a couple of years. Thankfully, Denise said he's taking his time, which I want him to take as long as you need to make sure this is quality.
I don't want to wait. I want to find out. I think he wants to make another movie before he makes the next one. I think he wants to wait a while.
Because there's like Cleopatra, and there's a couple of movies he already has like kind of like lined up,
kind of in the works. Yeah. So
yeah,
I mean, he's clearly making the Messiah. I think the way that he ends this movie on kind of a cliffhanger. Because there were debates of whether part two is going to be the last part, but I think after watching this movie, there's clearly going to be Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
Which, from what I've heard from the people who have read the books and know the arc of the story, it gets real complicated to depict after this. Because you lose a lot of just general storytelling that is typical in Hollywood movies when you get to Messiah and on. So we'll see what that looks like. And I think there's also supposed to be a prequel TV show that's possibly in the works, which I'm not really interested in, honestly, just because like these stories are clearly made for film, like in the large screen format and nothing else. I did want to talk to you, David, just about the final battle. Were you disappointed by the fact that we did, like, I think oftentimes when you're seeing this movie build to a climax, you're thinking you're about to see like Helm's Deep again,
mm-hmm.
which we didn't really get. I mean, the battle was brief. We got the attack of the sandworms and the nukes, and then we got Chani just absolutely running through some Imperial soldiers like it was nothing, which I thought was so much fun to watch. Yeah. And then it cuts to Paul killing Baron. The Baron. And then after that, we get the knife. We get the knife fight. Yeah. And so it wasn't this big battle. Was that disappointing to you in any way?
I'm not sure it was disappointing. I was definitely like surprised. You just assume there's going to be some conflict in that battle. And I was like, oh, wow, that was kind of easy for them. And so I'm kind of thinking maybe like, that's an intentional way to build to this third movie where we might get that Helm's Deep type, like it's been 15 minutes of this battle back and forth and back and forth. I don't know. And I haven't fully finished processing the movie. I don't think it was disappointing. It was still cool to see that. I think I was just surprised, like, wow, that was a really good plan. They cleaned that up, just because usually there's like, something goes wrong or there's pushback or like, oh, Zendaya didn't end up attacking and that side's left open, or, you know, there's like always something that goes wrong, I feel like, in a movie or like a battle sequence like this, but they just mm-hmm. cleaned him, bro.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So do you think that's what it is, like a build to the third movie, or you think it was an intentional like short
scene? It was an intentional, like it's showing that he has fully become the chosen one of like, this is him winning easily. And they use the sand so effectively. And I mean, it's clearly a brutal battle. Like almost all of the characters are drenched in blood by the end of it. You can see like dry blood covering all of their clothing and stuff. And so I think it was intentional. I think it still worked for me, but am I going to argue for a nice long battle? I mean, the Battle of the Helm's Deep is my favorite sequence in film ever. So it's not like I'm going to be anti that, you know, but I don't think it was required in this film. I want to also talk about, this is the last story aspect I want to specifically touch on. One of the things I haven't mentioned about Rebecca Ferguson's performance as Lady Jessica is what happens to her after she drinks the water of life and her relationship to her unborn child, Aaliyah Atreides, who is not surprisingly, if you saw the photos from the premiere and saw that Anya Taylor-Joy was there, but is clearly going to be portrayed by Anya Taylor-Joy in future installments of this franchise. Like, she just has to have a lot of conversations with an unborn, with a fetus in her womb. I thought that was strange. I thought it worked. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way that the film showed it. But I was just like, the first couple of times this was happening, I was like, what in the heck are we doing here? And I was like, is this just her manipulating, like her trying to manipulate Paul by saying, like, this is what your sister does? And then, no, it becomes very clear that the point of view of the movie is like that, yes, she's literally talking to her unborn child right now, like they're two adults having a conversation. How did you feel about that?
I don't know. Like, I wasn't like, it didn't like bring me out of the movie, but I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, it's interesting. And I think I heard in the books, it's a young child, right? In the books.
From what I've been told, yes, in the books, she actually is born during the second half of this. And then I don't know how accurate this is. I haven't read the books. I'm assuming that this is accurate, but I've read stuff and I've been told that, like, she is like a toddler warrior assassin running around by the end of the first book and is like responsible for actually killing the Baron. Like, she's the one who does it. Who is revealed to be her and Paul's grandfather when Paul drinks the water of life, which is...
Yeah, that was crazy.
Just imagine having that reveal, you know? Maybe that's the worst family shock ever, just having the giant slug man be your grandpa. Because you know what that implies? He has known a woman biblically, which is just a horrifying thought.
I don't know, man. Skywalkers, you know, turns out Rey is the Sith Lord is her granddad, or what is it?
I think this is gonna sound weird and probably worse because of Palpatine's kill count in the Star Wars films. I'd rather have Palpatine as a grandfather than a giant slug monster Baron Harkonnen. I think in a way Palpatine's somehow less gross. I don't know how, but they just well, I think so.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I just don't know how that's going to work. I was actually going to ask how you felt about it being Anya Taylor-Joy. And then, like, they show the future and she's like,
she's normal. On Arrakis, like a vision of
but
Arrakis.
There's no way that Doom Messiah she'll be normal Anya Taylor-Joy. It takes place right after. So
how long is this holy war though? Like, how long are we going to do time jumps? Because this movie takes place over what? 9 months. Less than 9 months, obviously, because she still has the baby. Like, this is a 6 month to 9 month movie. It's not just like a week or 2 weeks. It's clearly over a period of time. So I don't know how long this holy war lasts in the second book. It's possible, are we gonna go ahead and assume that Anya Taylor-Joy has like a normal life cycle? Like, she's gonna have to wait 20 years to be an adult. I mean, she's already having full conversations, apparently, and she hasn't even been born yet. So does she have, like, accelerated development? I don't know how that works.
Yeah,
I mean,
maybe drinking that, like, water of life, like, they'll explain, like, it completely – while she was in the womb, it completely changed how she developed or something.
It's that glacier freeze, baby.
That's facts.
It's just delicious. It does look good. I won't lie to you. It looks – yeah. It looks tasty. I think – after seeing the process of how it's extracted and knowing what it is, I would never drink it, but it does seem tasty just to look at it. So, all right, David, you ready to have some conversations about where this film and where Denis Villeneuve falls in terms of cinema history?
That sounds like a good conversation for, you know, that's overwhelming and that I don't necessarily know the answer to. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, first one, let's just start with Villeneuve. So I'm just gonna go ahead and read you his English language American releases, okay? Because he does, Denis Villeneuve, I mean, as you can guess from the way his name is pronounced, is obviously a French director who has French films, but he does have American films. And he's been releasing films in America for wide release since 2013. His most famous movie outside of that is Unsung D, which is an Academy Award winning, like, war film. that I have yet to see still that I'm really looking forward to, but just haven't been able to find yet. So, but anyway, here are the films that he's released. Enemy and Prisoners, both in 2013. Busy year for him. Sicario in 2015. Arrival in 2016. Blade Runner 2049 in 2017. Dune Part 1 in 2021. And Dune Part 2 in 2024. And he's a French-Canadian filmmaker, I guess I should say. He's not fully French. He's French-Canadian. Where does that fall in terms of like director output? Should we put him in the already like the top tier of directors of all time, even though he's made so few films? Because my least favorite of those is Enemy, which I still think is a solid movie. And then like the upper tier, I think are all A1 best movies of their respective years.
Yeah, Enemy's a 3.5 out of 5 for me, and literally every one of his movies after that are 4.5 or higher. I have Sicario, Prisoners, Blade Runner, Dune as 4.5s, and then now Dune Part 2 and Arrival's 5s.
Mm-hmm.
So just based on my ranking, it's definitely top 2. I'd probably have it even maybe over. This might be his number 1 film.
I think it is for me.
I just love Arrivals is such a different, like,
different sci-fi. Yeah,
it's so different than anything like I feel like somebody has done in terms of just limiting it to like an alien movie. It's just so like I don't know if euphorics the world, but just like it's so good to me, and I absolutely love that film. But I think initially, maybe just on recency bias, I think that this is his best movie. Mm-hmm. Now, after I might rewatch Arrival. It just arrived on Peacock. Might watch another film, and I might, that could change. You never know. But
mm-hmm. And I mean, he's clearly, I think it's him and Nolan in the last 15 years. Nolan, you could say even longer now that Dark Knight is 2008. Last 15, 20 years is signature to action filmmakers. I think they're especially with blockbusters, like there's obviously, you know, you have David Leitch, you have Gareth Edwards, you have some great action filmmakers, but I think that they're just on a different stratosphere. And I'm not ready to put him like all time directors, just because I think he needs more great movies under his belt. Because it's a lot about like how many can you make. Like Spielberg has legitimately like 20 great movies, so mm-hmm. you just have to keep going before you can get to that conversation. But of the last 25 years, I think he's in the top 5. Like I don't know how you can deny that based on, unless if you really just don't like his style, but I do. So Sicario, Arrival for me are both like A to A plus films, and both of the Dunes are. Blade Runner 2049 as well. I need to rewatch Prisoners. I haven't seen Prisoners since I was in high school. So I definitely need to revisit that one. I would like to revisit all of his movies, genuinely. But
it was on Netflix, but I don't think it is anymore.
I don't think so either. It's also just one of those movies that I want to rewatch it, but also I remember how brutal and depressing that movie was, so it's like mm-hmm. you know, when you're looking for something on a Friday night, it's not always what you go to. But
for whatever reason, man, every time I think about Sicario, I just have this deepest longing to rewatch it. Like, it's just such a clean, like, cleanly shot and developed movie to me that I just like it every time I watch it. I just specifically think about the on the highway to cross the border scenes.
Oh yeah, when they're like in the car. Insane. Yeah,
like I just want to. I want to watch the movie.
About to happen. Yeah, I always think of the ending with Benicio del Toro at the kitchen table.
Mm.
And that part's always tough for me. But again, an excellent film. I think he clearly has vaunted himself among the greatest living directors, the greatest active directors with. I mean, this was a slam dunk. He had all the hype in the world going to this. He had Christopher Nolan calling it the best sequel since Empire Strikes Back and his own sequel, The Dark Knight. And, you know, we've heard a lot of this is the next Dark Knight. It's mostly in regard to superhero films. But I think this is the first time that I felt that a sequel actually lived up to that hype.
So. Yeah, because that's even tough and maybe not even fair to like directors or films whenever this has that build up and hype. But it met it. Did it exceed that on top of meeting that?
It exceeded my expectations. Now, I know that one of our friends has already said that he believes that this film is better than Empire Strikes Back. Empire Strikes Back to me is the best science fiction film of all time. So if this is better than that, then this would be better, the best science fiction film of all time. I'm not ready to go there now. Part of that could definitely be nostalgia, but also like, I don't think I'm out of line and being like, let's calm down a little bit, because Empire Strikes Back is one of the five greatest movies ever made. So like, let's slow roll a little bit. But that the fact that it's even in the conversation to me is crazy.
Nathan, I have some pretty, I wouldn't say alarming news, like pretty revealing information. And this can be our next topic of conversation. If this movie were to enter into my top 50 movies of all time, I would actually have the same amount of Denis movies in my top 50 as Chris Nolan movies.
Are you having to switch your guy? Are you a Denis guy the whole time?
Rogue agent. I don't know if maybe, but like I'm realizing after watching Dune 2, like I think those two are closer to me, like closer for me than I originally thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think it's pretty easily like, well, those are one and two for me. Like,
in terms of directors,
just in terms of like right now, I just count on my top 50. I think those two probably have the most. Maybe Damien Chazelle is next with La La Land, Whiplash.
No respect to PTA, no respect to Babylon. Jeez.
Yeah, that's funny. That's another pod. I'd have to look. Actually, I'm curious, kind of what my top five like directors are. But that's just something I noticed. I was like, dang, that's crazy.
Yeah, I think that. He's quickly gone that way. And I mean, this movie, there's going to be a reaction, and I want to prepare everybody for that. There's going to be backlash. It happened with Oppenheimer. It happened with Barbie. It's going to happen with this movie. This movie is going to get so popular, and everybody's going to be talking it up so much that there's going to be people who turn around and are like, actually, Dune 2 sucks, and there's no story, and it's just explosions for 2.5 hours, and you guys are dumb, and I prefer this movie, and blah, blah, blah. That's going to happen, and you're just going to need to ignore those people because this thing's great. Where, David, I'm going to read some famous sequels off to you, and I just want you to let me know, if just gut reaction, if you think Dune Part 2 is better than the sequels. Okay. Oh,
man, okay. All right.
All right. We'll start off a little different. Toy Story 2.
Yes.
Captain America the Winter Soldier.
Yes.
Okay. T2 Judgment Day.
Yes.
Okay. Aliens.
Maybe. Not as confident on that one.
Paddington 2.
Yes.
Shrek 2.
Yes.
Back to the Future 2.
Yes.
Empire Strikes Back.
I don't know if I can say that. I think I got to sit on this a lot longer than, not even 24 hours.
Probably need to see it again, right? You can't.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Okay. The Dark Knight.
Even Aliens. Aliens, Dark Knight, and Empire Strikes Back. I don't know if I can say that quite yet. Quite yet.
Because that is the upper echelon. Those are often considered the greatest sequels of all time, rightfully so. I would consider them that. I don't know. I'm not as big of a Dark Knight guy as you. I think this one's pretty close for me. To be fair, I didn't see The Dark Knight in IMAX. You know, if I watched the flipping of the semi truck in an IMAX theater, I might just be talking about that for the rest of my life.
Oh my
God. Which I think is why it's so important to see these big movies on a big screen. Two Towers.
Probably not.
Okay.
Probably it's in that same, like, I don't know yet.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's top 10 as far as sequels go. which is, can we now stop the narrative that the it's been like this long running thing that like, oh, the sequels like are often bad and like the second movie is not as good as the first one. I think we have so many like examples to the contrary that now that seems like a dumb talking point, right? Like universally, everybody agrees that Empire Strikes Back is pretty much everybody agrees it's better than A New Hope and like one of the best movie in that series. Well, I mean, same thing with either one of the Lord of the Rings sequels. Same thing with the Terminator sequel. Same thing with the second Aliens movie. Now, there's obviously going to be different opinions. Same thing with The Dark Knight. Like, these are all very famous examples of the sequel being better.
Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. You didn't even mention that one.
It's not even in the same. I mean, that's a good movie.
It is.
Don't get me wrong. But is it the same conversation? I don't know. And now Dune Part 2. Like, I'm not really here for the, like, normally the sequel's worse, but here's an example where it's better. Like, yeah, that's the case whenever they clearly just make a sequel to a movie because they were surprised by how much movie the original made and they don't even get all the cast to return and things like that. Like, yeah, you know what that's the case in? That's the case with Aquaman 2, when they have to explain that Willem Dafoe's character was just killed by a plague off screen because Willem Dafoe was like, I'm not returning for that garbage. I already seen the first one. I don't care. Like, yeah, that's true for that. But like an actual franchise that has care and consideration when it's being made and has like continuity of filmmaker and continuity of writing, the sequels are normally better. Like, I'm tired of this.
Yeah.
So that's a weird soapbox.
I think I had that take for a while. I don't remember when it started or if it ended. I don't, you know, but yeah.
I just think it's really weird that we are just so quick to be like, oh, the sequels, you know, you never know. Mm-hmm. They're always worse. It's like, I don't think that that's true.
Yeah.
But that's whatever.
We'll probably get to, well, we kind of already talked about directors. I'm curious, and this may be an easy answer. Will this movie crack your top 50 all-time favorite movies?
Yeah, I'm actually doing that as we speak. I'm trying to figure out where it's at so I can content for this podcast.
I was going to say, the way you're talking about like one of your favorite movie experiences ever, like I feel like when a comment's made like that, that has to be, I mean, at least your top 20 of movies.
I've given 30 movies 5 stars in my life, and this is going to be one of them. So,
mm-hmm. Now, contextually, you've watched over 2,000 movies, so that's not a lot of 5-star movies, even though it sounds like it up front. You know,
it is being placed at... is being put at number
4 or after La La Land?
It's being put at number 16 right now. So to list the movies that are directly in front of and behind it, it is in front of, or it is right behind Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, and Pulp Fiction. And it is right in front of Goodfellas and The Godfather. That's where I have it right now. However, we could do recency bias. Again, like every time I watch Goodfellas, I'm like, is Goodfellas one of my 5 favorite movies I've ever seen? And a lot of these just cycle. Like once you get in the top 20 for me, like I'm good with anything.
It's hard to go wrong.
Like you could convince me with anything pretty much. So it's there, but yeah, I'd say it's firmly in my top 20 and will probably stay there. Unless on rewatch, I'm just like, oh, that was bad. But I don't really see a way that happens. So
I'm curious. We never even talked about this and you may have forgotten. Will Oppenheimer crack your top 50? Crack your top 50?
It's not right now. However, I am feeling, I'm just going to express this.
Of course, you've only watched it once, which I keep forgetting that.
Mm-mm. Twice in IMAX, boy. Don't test me.
Oh, that's right. You didn't rewatch it with us, but you ended up rewatching it.
I did rewatch it.
That's right.
You psychopaths rewatched it like the next day or something. Like,
I've seen it 4 times now.
and that's your guy. I like Oppenheimer. I think the second time I watched Oppenheimer, I was like, this is still a really, really good movie. But normally the second time I watch one of my favorites of all time, I'm like, oh my God, I love this thing so much. And the second time I watched Oppenheimer, I found myself critiquing it, just critiquing little things about it. Again, I think it's a great movie. I think it deserves to be Best Picture. I felt myself critiquing it more than praising it. I felt myself trying to pick holes in it. So I just don't think, like, I think it's good enough. It's just not one of my favorites, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, you're right. No. Mean Girls has no holes, but that's fine.
Mean Girls is not on the top 50 anymore. I don't know.
Oh, that's probably true. It's not updated.
Like, I'm at a certain point, like, we're looking like, I don't know. Like, my 50th movie is Tombstone. You know? And
yeah.
Tombstone has one of my favorite performances ever. Possibly the coolest person ever in a movie is Val Kilmer in Tombstone. Seriously. He just is. As yeah. Doc Holliday. And that's 50 for me. Like, I don't know. Yeah. It's a lot.
I don't know. I mean, top 50 is not even like these are the 50th best movies. It's like, it's your preference, like your favorite, like
right.
You know,
I will just say I believe Oppenheimer deserves best picture this year. And oftentimes, as you know, I like to be different, and I normally don't pick the front runner as the movie I think should be best picture. Normally I think it should go to another movie. And I think there's many great movies, but I've been firm in that since I saw Oppenheimer, I was like, that's the best movie of 2023. And I watched a lot of other 2023 movies since then. And Oppenheimer is still the best movie of 2023 for my money. So,
yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, obviously.
And you somehow found a way to have me talk about Oppenheimer on the Dune 2 podcast. Congratulations.
I mean, to put that in perspective, I have Skyfall in my top 50. So it's definitely not like the 50th best movies of all time.
No, yeah, I don't.
I saw a post like, which one's Daniel Craig's best 007 movie? I kept scrolling. I'm like, it's not even competition, bro. Skyfall is just beautiful.
I'm going to rewatch Casino Royale and get back to me. I'm not saying that it's not okay. Skyfall, but I'm saying Casino is not a little easy. Closer than you're thinking. Yeah, it's definitely not Spectre or No Time to Die or Quantum of Solace. None of those movies are good to not even good, but I would say Casino Royale is giving Skyfall a little run for its money.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know where I'm going to put. Right now it's 50, but I just added it to the list.
I would expect it to be in your top 15.
Yeah.
We'll see. I mean, I think it all comes down to how we feel after coming out of our second viewing on Saturday.
Yeah. 15 for me right now is No Country for Old Men, which is another just a dark movie.
And the problem with these, like, anybody gives a crap about what our letterbox lists are. But the problem with these is that it's all just like what I saw recently. Like, other than the top three movies, which have been my top three movies since 2019 when the third one came out. I have had Two Towers, Empire Strikes Back, and Little Women as my top three of all time. Those have not changed. That has been constant. Everything else has changed. That has been constant. But these other ones, like, I'll watch Heat and then be like, Heat's four. And then I'll watch Fury Road and be like, Fury Road's four. And then I'll watch, I don't know, like...
The Red Shoes,
and The Red Shoes will be four. I'll watch There Will Be Blood, and There Will Be Blood will be four. Like, some of these just, if it's a five-star film, it's a five-star film for me. So it'll just rotate in there, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of the case for me with, like, Whiplash, La La Land, Heat. I will say, though, I had seen There Will Be Blood before, and on rewatch, I bumped that a whole star, and it hopped all the way up to number eight on my list. So that was kind of nice.
So good, dude. Paul Thomas Anderson, have you seen the stuff for his next movie? It's coming out. It's like he's getting like a $200 million budget, and it's supposed to be like his most commercial film of all time. And it's going to star Leo. I think Leonardo DiCaprio is going to be the lead.
I heard about that.
Yeah, this is great news for America. I'm just going to say right now. And it's probably not going to make $200 million, and people are going to call it a bomb and whatever and blah, 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 blah. Give PTA all the money. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. That also happened with me, Good Will Hunting. I know you're not as high on that, but I rewatched it. I was like, I love it.
Good Will Hunting's still amazing. It's not a five-star film for me, but it's still amazing.
Yeah. I mentioned that now Chris and Denis are one and two at four films in my top 50. You probably could guess who the number three director is with the most films on my top 50.
Well, they both have four, so the next one has three.
Correct.
Is it Spielberg?
No. I'm also doing this on the fly.
Sir, okay. Well, but talk me through this. Because I know you have to have Jurassic Park.
Okay, there's two tied now. Spielberg is one of them. I have two Indiana Jones and Jurassic Park.
Thank you. Yeah.
I have Raiders... And then Last Crusade.
Is there another guy? Quentin? Is it Tarantino?
Mm-mm.
You're not a Tarantino guy. I'm overthinking. Just spoil it for me, and then I'm going to get mad.
Fincher.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm so
believe it or not, I got Gone Girl 7, and I have Social Network, which I rewatched Social Network recently, and it moved up the list for me. But, yeah.
Oh, it's Fincher. David Fincher. Okay.
It's a pretty good list. Denis, well, Chris, Fincher, and Spielberg.
I mean, yeah, those are... aside from, I guess you could say, aside from Spielberg, the Denis, Fincher, and Chris may be the signature filmmakers of the 21st century.
Which makes sense. Like, I'm growing up with them, so to me, they're those guys mm-hmm. that these older directors are for the last generation, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that and whoever directed Morbius, so...
That's funny. I got a lot of two directors, you know, Francis, I got Peter Jackson too. I got Coen brothers too. I got, you know, once you get
mine might actually be Peter Jackson because I have three. I'm trying to look. There's,
I think I only have one Scorsese film, believe it or not.
One, two, three. There's four Tarantino movies in mine.
Got you.
Two Fincher.
Nathan, I don't think I have a Tarantino movie on my top 50.
Yeah, it's just insane. Rewatching Glorious Bastards and get back to me.
Okay. I've actually been wanting to watch that and Pulp Fiction. But
have you not seen either one of those films? Now we're just talking. We're not even talking about Dune.
We're just talking about movies. No, I've seen both. I saw Pulp Fiction in high school, like way before I like did deep dive into movies. I think I'd appreciate both a lot more now. But in high school, I was just like, dude, this is just a lot. I'm exhausted. You know,
I was, I think, poisoned by a very well-meaning history teacher that instilled in me in high school, and this is the reason I need to rewatch the movie JFK, that instilled in me that any movie about a historical event should just be accurate. And if it's not accurate, then like if it's not like by the book accurate, then it's like dangerous. So it kind of turned me off of movies like Inglourious Basterds and JFK, because Inglourious Basterds is obviously just like a work of a fiction about like what happened if we actually killed Hitler. And then JFK is just like a conspiracy theory movie about like mm-hmm. who killed Kennedy, which is not really grounded in reality, but is still a fun movie. And so I was thinking like, these are bad movies because they're not correct. They're not true. That's not the case for a movie. So I need to, I already reevaluated Inglourious Basterds, but I need to reevaluate some movies that maybe I was,
yeah,
it was antagonistic towards.
Quick note, I want to shout out three different directors that I have two movies of. Greta Gerwig, newest edition with Little Women, well, not withstanding Dune. Two Wes Anderson, classic. Two Sidney Lumet films, Dog Day Afternoon and 12 Angry Men.
Yeah, that makes sense. He's so good. So he's amazing.
I'm actually in the middle of Doctor Strangelove right now. There's about 25 minutes left.
Did you watch that? Because I watched it last night.
Well, and I think it might be with you. I've been wanting to watch that, but it's like not been on anything. It's one of those like classics I've been wanting to watch. And I saw that. I was like, where is it at?
It's so funny, too.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, jeez. Anyway, we just spent the last 15 minutes not even coming close. But Dune 2, go watch it if you can. Watch the first Dune and then rewatch the first Dune just so you can remember what's going on, because you got to know what's happening.
You can watch it without it, but it helps to know.
Yeah. You just want to know what's going on in that old sweet desert world of spice.
Yeah.
And they kind of update you with what recently happened.
Yeah.
But it's still better to do that. And then watch Dune 2 on the biggest screen that you can find, and then just be happy with your life for at least a little bit until you realize.
Yeah.
Yes. Nathan, bills.
Final thing on our outline tonight. You typed in this question, how does Dune 2 affect LeBron's legacy? And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
I mean, I think it clearly shows that, while LeBron may be by many and was graced on Sports Illustrated in 2003, was called the chosen one, that Paul Atreides is in fact the true chosen one, because he's the only male who's ever drank the water of life and lived, which is something that LeBron can't say. So I think that he's losing his GOAT argument because of this. And, you know, 40,000 points is great and all, but have you had the glacier freeze from a sandworm, my guy? So that's what I would say to that.
I'd say that all but seals it there. I'm not sure I need to add to that. It's pretty good. That wasn't actually in the outline. I made that up for those who were
really wow.
Nine at the bit to know if that was really on the outline.
Yeah, what a shock.
That is carefully built piece by piece and letter by
Nobody's
letter.
Made it to this point of the podcast anyway, so you don't have to worry about that.
That's fair. Anything else? Hour and 10. It's pretty good for Dune 2. It's worthy.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, it's been Dune 2 talk. Watch this movie in theaters on the big screen. You will regret it. You will look back and wonder and wish you had watched it in the theater. So do it. Spend the money. Mm-hmm. Bring a friend. It's going to be a fun experience. Mm-hmm. Glad we could talk about it on What Do You Want to Watch. And Nathan, I know what we're watching on Saturday, and that's Dune 2. So I guess we'll see you guys later.
See you guys later.